We'll conclude the hour by flashing back to before Google was a verb, before it employed 28,000 employees worldwide, before its inventors, fellow Stanford University grad students Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who joined forces on a research project in 1996, were billionaires. Google's first office was located in a friend's garage in Menlo Park, California. By 1999, it had several dozen employees and a bright but uncertain future. That's when Doug Edwards joined on as Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management at Google from 1999 to 2005. His new book is called I'm Feeling Lucky, Confessions of Google Employee Number 59. Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So if we can liken the maturation of a company to that of a person, what was the developmental age of Google when you joined as employee number 59? Was it 9? Was it sweet 16?
I'd go back to toddler stage. maybe the terrible twos, actually.
And as you noted, before you started at Google, you'd never heard any of the following said on the job, and I'll read a few of them. Sorry, did I get the printer? Super soakers are really inaccurate at more than 5 feet. And is there any way to set the sauna for more than half an hour? And, oh, didn't realize anyone was napping in here. And my personal favorite, who do I ask if I have a question about Windows? No one?
Well, you know, it was very different from the company I left behind, which was part of a large corporate chain. Everything was very structured. I knew exactly what my job was. I knew who I reported to and the things that I was expected to do and the things that I was not allowed to do. I got to Google and all that went out the window. It was a completely open environment, very non-hierarchical, and the assumption was that if you found a problem, you would just go ahead and fix it.
Google had grandiose dreams of saving the world. It wanted to build a company, you wrote, to fix large-scale problems affecting millions of people and terraform the entire landscape of human knowledge. They wanted to speed medical breakthroughs, accelerate the exploration of space, break down language barriers.
All of those things came from conversations I had with Larry Page, who's CEO of the company. He knew that the search engine was not the end state of what Google would be as an entity. It was the first step.
Is he where the don't be evil mantra came from?
That actually came out of one of those corporate culture feel-good meetings where a bunch of employees were gathered together to discuss mutually shared values in the company. And one of the attendees was Paul Buchheit, an engineer, and you know, he was somebody who wrote a lot of code, and as people started coming up with all these individual rules like respect other people's time and show up to meetings when you're supposed to be there, he said, we only need one rule instead of all these little ones, and that rule should be don't be evil. It just covers everything. Much more efficient. So it was originally intended as an internal guideline for people and their interactions with other Googlers, but it slipped out and became associated with the company at large.
Give me a characteristic interaction with the two founders of the company, Larry Page and Sergey Brin.
I went into a meeting to discuss some marketing on the homepage of Google, and I said, you know, here are some promotional lines that we could put on the homepage, and we could track and see if people came back more often when they saw these lines or how often they clicked on them. And they looked at each other, and Sergey said, no, I don't think this is the way to go. What we should really do is turn the homepage of Google hot pink and see what effect that has on traffic. A lot of times, the things that I thought were patently ridiculous turned out to be pretty good ideas. And I'll give the example of playing with the logo on the homepage. Sergey proposed that we toy with a logo. We put up some cartoon aliens on it. And I said, you've got to be kidding. From a branding standpoint, you don't mess with your logo. The logo is sacrosanct. And he insisted, and people actually loved having the logos change on Google.
You said that he once suggested that Google use its whole marketing budget to, quote, inoculate Chechen refugees against cholera. He said it would, quote, help our brand awareness and we'll get more new people to use Google.
Yeah, he was not a believer in traditional advertising. You know, he didn't want to go the route that everybody else did. So his idea was we'll do something that generates some great public relations for Google. It'll do some public good and everybody comes out ahead. What I came to realize is that the product really was the marketing. Google worked so much better than its competitors. So I started focusing my efforts on creating a more human face for Google's products. And that came through the language we used to talk to our users, the April Fool's jokes, and so forth.
You mention a desktop search engine developed by Google that indexed the hard drive of a personal computer and searched its contents. It was originally called Total Recall. But you say that that was deemed too scary. As a result, they decided to call it Fluffy Bunnies.
That was the internal code name, and we were fined, actually, if we called it Total Recall. We had to pay a dollar each time we did that.
Uh-huh.
We'd already gone through a couple of instances where people had been very concerned about the privacy implications of products Google had launched, and we really wanted to make sure that we addressed those concerns before we launched the product. There was the example of the Google toolbar, which also had the capability of scaring people, because one of the features was it allowed you to see the page rank anytime you visited a new site on the internet. But to do that, Google had to look at every site you visited, which is kind of scary. So we could easily have buried notification of that feature in the licensing agreement that nobody ever reads. You know, everybody just scrolls down to the end of it and then clicks I accept. But instead, we put in this big warning message in bright red text that said, read this. It's not the usual yada yada. And then below that, it explained exactly what the feature did. So we were very cognizant of the fact that people had privacy concerns and that we needed to be upfront with them.
It's still the place where Google is most likely to be regarded as evil.
Yeah, you know, they've had some missteps. I mean, and I think the way we handled the launch of Gmail exacerbated that. People stopped trusting us so much when they felt like we were reading their email to put targeted advertising in, which was not, in fact, the case. And I think there was a real disconnect there between the founders and the engineers and the public. I talk about in the book an incident where I went to Sergey and I said, we're getting all these emails about how upset people are with the privacy issue. We need to address that. And he said, there is no privacy issue. Because in his mind, we weren't doing anything wrong. He knew that we were not reading people's email to put in these targeted ads. So if we weren't doing it, there was no issue. And we had a little bit of a discussion around perception, reality. He didn't quite get that. The fact people were upset meant that it was an issue for us.
The fact that everything you do online can be cataloged by Google and used to enable advertisers to serve us better is not a reality?
It's not something Google tries to hide. But when you go online, everything you do is tracked by machines. I mean, that's how they function. That's how they're able to give you the things that you want. So you're giving up something to get something you want. And, you know, there are some companies that are devious about how much information they collect. So you should always be careful. I mean, the example Google engineers would always give me when people complained about privacy was they think we're tracking them. What about their internet service provider? We only look at what they're doing on Google. Their internet service provider knows everything they do, every site they visit.
Yeah, but that's a deflection more than an actual addressing of the issue. It's true that the internet service providers may be even more intrusive, but that doesn't mean that what you do on Google and the fact that it can be tracked, cataloged, and utilized isn't potentially a problem.
From Google's standpoint, though, the information that's collected is used to improve the products that they're giving you. I'll give you an example. The spell checker that everybody sees on Google that says, did you mean when you misspell something?
Mm-hmm.
That uses technology that is based on what people search for. So it knows that if people search for something and then search again with an alternate spelling and then search again with yet another spelling, they probably view all those spellings as related and the last one is probably the correct one. So if they don't track the history of those searches, they're not able to use that technology to improve the spell checker. My argument was always, we should tell people we're doing this. We should let people know this is the trade-off that they're making. And Larry's answer at the time was, we don't want our competitors to know that we're using this data to improve our products. So we can't talk about it. We can't talk about the benefit people get in exchange for the privacy that they're giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an ongoing debate within the company, and I think probably still is.
Google came closest to being accused of evil when it enabled the Chinese to dictate how it functioned in that space.
In the early days, Google was able to work through problems by developing better technology. They got to China, and they tried that. They tried moving the servers to Hong Kong and doing different things, but the problem was much larger and intractable. And I think this is where Google is now as a company. They're facing much bigger, more complex problems than can be solved simply by the way engineers like to solve problems, which is, oh, let's build a new technology that will do something different. So, you know, I look at that and I see them brushing up against the real world. And I think this is going to be the future of Google. They're always going to have to deal with questions like monopoly, censorship, when often there is no perfect solution to the problem.
Doug, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Doug Edwards was Director of Consumer Marketing and Brand Management at Google from 1999 to 2005. His new book is I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee No. 59. Google co-founder Sergey Brin appeared on an episode of the game show To Tell the Truth 11 years ago. On the show, Brin and two Brin imposters were presented to a panel of celebrities who tried to figure out which one was the real one. Host John O'Hurley began by reading a statement by the real Sergey.
I, Sergey Brin, co-founded the Internet's largest search engine, Google. Not only is our site one of the hippest on the web, but our work environment at the Googleplex is heaven for employees. All right, panel and audience. These three young gentlemen all claim to be the real Google guru. Which one is it?
Number two, why is your search engine so much better than everyone else's?
Well, we return the best things first.
Number three, what's a search engine?
It's a tool used by the internet community to find other websites.
All right, time is up. Time for our celebrity panel to lock in their votes.
I voted for number three.
And I was pretty darn impressed with his technical answer, so I think it's number three.
I went with number three because I think he looks like Sergey.
Will Ariel, Sergey Brin, please stand up.
To everybody's surprise, number two stands up.
Number three, who are you and what do you do?
My name is R.D. Miller Jr. and I'm a professional bowler.
You stumped everybody. $5,000 will be split. Come on, the three of you. Thank you very much for playing.
Oh, goodbye. Google Eye. Eat 'em up, Google Eye, Google Eye, Google Eye. Eat 'em up, Google Eye, Google Eye, Google Eye. Goodbye. Google Eye.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, DJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Emily Chin and Joe Rosenberg, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Graham.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.